The Church of God, the Eternal, presents How to Pass the Big Test, a message given by Mr. John Brisby in Eugene, Oregon, June 1st, 2024.
Well, I've had this message prepared for a long time and intended to use it as a future travel sermon, but then decided, no, I'll just give it to the entire church through this recording on this Sabbath here in Eugene, Oregon. I've entitled it, How to Pass the Big Test. How to Pass the Big Test. And what do I mean by that? Well, there's many in God's church over many decades who have been conditioned with what I call a false notion concerning future tests for God's people in the very last days, especially in the days that involve persecution, prophesied persecution before the return of Jesus Christ. And so it was always portrayed in the idea that we may face the day when the soldier comes to the door. And I've mentioned this to you before, so you've nothing new, but I want to expand on it. You know, so the idea is like, will I have the faith when the soldier comes and beats on my door and demands that I renounce the name of my God? Would I have the faith in that moment to stand strong and to resist uttering a rejection of my faith? I'm not saying that that's not going to happen. But what I am saying is that's really not your biggest worry or mine. There are many other scenarios that are the true threat to God's people in the last days leading to the second coming of Jesus Christ. And I want to expand on that this afternoon. My main message to you is to expect the unexpected. Well, okay, great. That's a nice platitude, but how do you expect the unexpected? And then what do you do with that? Let's start again from understanding, because God thankfully has given us enough instances in the Bible to actually show us what we should be focusing on. And if you want to be prepared to pass the big tests in your life, whatever they may be, before the end of your course in the flesh, how can you be prepared so that you don't get caught unawares and end up making a crucial mistake that robs you of your eternal salvation? You really shouldn't have to live in doubt. But it's a whole lot more meaty than this idea of, I hope I can, you know, not curse God when the soldier knocks on my door. Expect the unexpected. Matthew 26, verse 31. I love this example. I've cited it many times over the years. And God recorded it here in the Gospels for a reason, because here were the close disciples of Jesus Christ. He had instructed them during his 3.5-year ministry, and now at the culmination, he's giving them a final warning at Passover. Matthew 26, 31. Then saith Jesus to all of them, all you shall be offended because of me this night. For it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered abroad. Well, then it's whatever happened afterwards, not their fault, right? It was prophesied, so it had to happen. So they were just all fatalistically going along with the predetermined program, right? Wrong. They were all free moral agents with the full right and the obligation to make a personal choice. It's just that God knew from the beginning what they were all going to do and wrote it down. I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered abroad, but after I am risen again, I will go before thee into Galilee. Peter answered and said unto him, though all men shall be offended because of thee, yet I will never be offended. So, poor old Peter. You know, but his role and what he did and what God recorded about this event is absolutely critical and valuable for you and me. But here was an incredibly courageous man. And probably among all the other disciples, he was, you know, the greatest patriot and a man of courage. Compared to others, you know, who may have been more naturally by personality timid or, you know, whatever, Peter was the epitome of a man's man and willing to step out and to face danger. And probably then because of his own history in life, he confidently believed he was prepared to pass the greatest test. Though all men shall be offended because of thee, yet will I never be offended. Jesus saith unto him, verily I say unto you that this night before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. Peter said unto him, though I shall die. So now he's going to contend with Jesus. Jesus says, I'm telling you what's going to happen. And he's going, nah, 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 nah. Because I know myself better. You can't tell me I'm going to do this when I know I would never do that. Though I should die with thee, yet will I not deny thee. And the other disciples can't let Peter get away with, you know, being the only one to proclaim his strength and his courage. So they likewise also said all the disciples. So here is a classic example of these chosen servants of God taught at the feet of the very Messiah, being prepared through instruction for what they needed to be able to do and the way to think in order to pass the big test. It's their equivalent of the soldier knocking on the door and demanding, either renounce this crazy cult religion of yours or else, and being willing to say, I will never renounce my God. Do your worst. So this same Jesus Christ who warned these disciples, you really don't yet get it. You don't have all the pieces that you need, because they didn't. They didn't have access to the Holy Spirit yet, right? Not until after the death of Jesus Christ, not until Pentecost to follow. The indwelling of the Spirit, which was going to give them the beginning of being able to put on real faith, which is a fruit of that Spirit. And they did they not? I mean, these same men who made these mistakes yet went on to write an incredible history of faithfulness and courage to defend the faith. And every one of them except John actually died as a martyr. So these were not shrinking violets. And they did demonstrate later the willingness to die for their faith. But at this time, when they thought they already had all the pieces, they didn't. This same Jesus Christ said also that many of his people in the very last days would betray one another under pressure. Notice Matthew 24, verse 9 and 10. Because his disciples specifically ask him, well, tell us about what's going to happen. Matthew 24, verse 9, Christ said, then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted. Somebody's going to be arrested. Somebody's going to be incarcerated. Somebody's going to be hauled before a judicial system. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted and shall kill you. Some are literally going to be put to death. Not 2,000 years ago, we're talking about in our future, before the second coming of Jesus Christ. This is going to happen. And shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. Still hard to understand how that can be possible. Who are we? We're nobodies. And we're certainly no threat. We don't even get involved in politics. And yet, the true church of God is going to come under the spotlight and the derision of the majority in this earth, because your enemy, your invisible enemy, Satan the devil, who is still the god of this world, knows exactly who you are, and he wants to get you more than anyone else. So these forces are going to coalesce, and I can't tell you how it's going to unfold. I just know what Christ said here, and we take it that it's true, right? So if you're a part of the true church of God and you are following his revealed way of life, then you will come under the spotlight of the world at some point, and you're going to be hated of all nations. I don't know, maybe it's because of the ministry of the two witnesses. They're certainly going to be hated. And maybe anybody who subscribes to those two fanatics, quote unquote, religion, are going to get caught up in the net. But human beings love, to root out insurgencies, especially when they feel threatened. So something's going to make them feel threatened by your faith. And these powers are going to come after anybody who has any historical connection, probably with that Herbert Armstrong guy who taught the Sabbath and the holy days and some of these doctrines which are considered hateful in the world today. I mean, if they can round up anybody who happened to be a part of a protest a couple of years ago in Washington, D.C., and by extension, charge them and throw them in jail. You see the philosophy that's around. Anything they deem is serious enough, then forget justice. The ends justify the means. We have every right to expunge these people who have this dangerous ideology. And whether you do or whether you're not, or whether you're a real threat or whether you're not, the people of God are going to get caught up in the net. Well, that's pretty depressing. But what's the point? Because of those circumstances, which are going to be real one day, what is the effect on the church? Verse 10, and then shall many be offended. Many who? Many in the world? No. Many in the church, many called as the children of God, are going to become offended by what they experience when the church is persecuted by the world. So some are going to be martyred. And others, in fact, many in God's church, are going to demonstrate that they have no more faith than Peter did. Because Peter and all those disciples absolutely abandoned Jesus at the time that he was being arrested. Where were these strong guys? Oh, though everyone else be offended, I will never be offended. I'm willing to die with you. And then they ran away. And I used to say, like little girls, and there's somebody who doesn't like it when I say that. Yeah, I've known some little girls that are pretty tough. But in general, you know what I mean. They think they're so strong and they're courageous, but in the thick of the reality of the trial, they do what comes naturally, which is to save the self. Human beings are hardwired for self-preservation. And that's what Peter and the other disciples did when they ran away and abandoned Christ in his moment of need. And that's the same philosophy which is going to affect the majority in God's true church in the last days. So said Christ right here. Then, after the persecution begins and even some are killed because of subscribing to this way of life, many of God's people are going to panic and seek cover. Then shall many be offended. Offended at who? They're going to be offended at God and the faith. Even if they don't say that outwardly. The truth is, they are now going to change their opinion about what they've been doing. Can't believe I've been a member of that church, because now that put a target on my back with the government. Many shall be offended, and what will they do? And shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. Isn't that interesting? Well, no, I would never do that. I would never do that. Persecution comes, the church is attacked, because we've always been taught this is going to happen. I would never turn on my brothers and sisters of the faith. I would never allow myself to become offended at the commandments, statutes, and judgments of God. I've done it all my life. Oh, I'd be scared, but surely, surely under pressure, if the soldier comes to my door and demands I renounce my religion, my Herbert Armstrong roots, I'll be willing to say, no way. Well, you can think that about you, and I can think that about me, and then you're in no better place than Peter and the disciples were when they also asserted how strong they were to defend Christ. But they weren't. What could cause God's true people to turn on each other? Christ said this is going to happen. It will be a reality. My question to you, my dear friends, what makes you different than this majority that Christ prophesied is going to show itself? He said not a few, but many. Many of his called people will be offended and then will turn and betray one another. Many are going to do that. Why are you not going to be in that group? What's the real answer? Because there is an answer, and there is a formula, and there is a program that you can follow. And if you're serious about it, you don't have to be in that category. Even though many, even the majority, are going to get caught up in it, so said Christ, you don't have to be one of them. If you are thoughtful about applying yourselves now in the right way of thinking and behaving. But what I'm admonishing you to do is get out of this simplistic idea that it's just about being able to face the soldier at the door and in that moment say, I will not renounce my religion. It's more than that. Okay, then what's the answer? Well, it starts by understanding what it was that undermined God's called people in times past. So we're going to go back to ancient Israel. Okay. What was it that always undid Israel's relationship with God? If you see that and if you can apply it to yourself today, you are in a strong position to avoid making the same mistakes that they made. So let's look at a couple of examples, starting in Deuteronomy 32. Deuteronomy 32, verse 18. Deuteronomy 32, 18, of the rock that beget thee, the same Jesus Christ, the same God of the Old Testament who led them through the wilderness, here he is, of the rock that beget thee, thou art unmindful. This is what God says to his called people. Thou art unmindful and hast forgotten God that formed thee. And when the Eternal saw it, he abhorred them because of the provoking of his sons and of his daughters. They're not the ones being provoked. The sons and daughters are the ones provoking God. How did they provoke God? How did they separate themselves from God, who promised to bless them and give them all these good things and protect them? And yet they turned and provoked him. Stupid thing to do, right? Why did they do it? Because of the provoking of his sons and of his daughters, verse 20, and he said, I will hide my face from them. In other words, because of their misbehavior, they separated themselves from God, which was the source of their security. I will hide my face from them, God says, and I will see what their end will be. Let's see what happens to them because they didn't like me. So they thought they had a better way and they pushed me away. Fine. This is God saying, fine. Let them go their way and let's see what the end will be without me fighting their battles for them. I will see what their end shall be, for they are a very froward generation, children in whom is no faith. So the first lesson is faith, real faith, is required. Okay, but how does that help me? How do I know if I have the faith? Again, Peter and the other disciples thought they had the faith to stand against threat to life and limb and to stand shoulder to shoulder with Jesus Christ when the soldiers came. They thought they had the faith, the belief, the conviction, and they didn't. So it's one thing to know you got to have faith. It's another thing to know, well, how do we get it? Children in whom is no faith. So that was the great weakness and the downfall of ancient Israel, which is what all of their history of mistakes shows. Ezekiel 20, verse 10. Ezekiel 20, verse 10. Wherefore I caused them to go forth out of the land of Egypt and brought them into the wilderness. And I gave them my statutes and showed them my judgments, which if a man do, he shall even live by them. Moreover, I gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between me and them, that they might know that I am the Eternal that sanctifies them. You know how important the weekly and the annual Sabbaths are? If you read the Bible, it seems God cares about them. And he said these Sabbaths were the sign, the link, if you will, between God and his true people. Verse 13, but the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They walked not in my statutes. They despised my judgments. What are the judgments? Judgments are judicial interpretations of the law, which apply to individual cases that come up. So it's taking the Ten Commandments and the statutes and then applying them, and then a judge in Israel who was supposed to actually weigh a case that came before him and make a decision of guilt, innocence, culpable parties. They didn't like the judgments of God. When they didn't get the outcome they wanted from the court, then they turned and pointed a finger at God. It shows they really didn't like his laws or the execution of his laws when it didn't benefit them in the way they wanted or demanded. They walked not in my statutes. They despised my judgments, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. The blessing was for those who embraced the statutes and the judgments of God and came to agree with them and to appreciate them and live within them. They could have been blessed, the most blessed people on the face of the earth. But it went against their nature, and they always trusted themselves more. And my Sabbaths, they greatly polluted. Comes up over and over and over again. My Sabbaths, they greatly polluted. Then I said, and what was God's action because of their behavior? Then I said I would pour out my fury upon them in the wilderness to consume them, and that's exactly what happened. Drop down to verse 16. Because they despised my judgments and walked not in my statutes, but polluted my Sabbaths. There it is again. For why? Why did they violate the Sabbath? Why could they never really embrace them and make those Sabbaths their own? For their heart went after their idols. There's the key. What stood between Israel and true Sabbath keeping? Idolatry. Idolatry of mind. For their heart went after their idols. I'm not talking about stone and wood and whatever. Idols are anything we put before God. Your idols, my idols of mind, are the things which God despises and wants us to get rid of. And anything can be an idol that stands in opposition to what God revealed to be the truth and the way he wants us to act and behave. And if we disagree with some part of that, I don't believe that's true. I don't think God wants us to do that. I don't think I need to do that. There's an idol. It's another way to say a rejection of the faith once delivered, just saying. Verse 19, I am the Eternal your God, he says. Walk in my statutes, keep my judgments, and do them. Don't contend with me. stop using your legalistic, lawyerly interpretation of Greek and Hebrew words to come up with your own justification to do what you want to do. Because I revealed the truth. I told you the way to do it. It came through Moses. And God is, in essence, saying, I didn't stutter. I made sure you had everything you needed to know. I am the eternal, your God. Walk in my statutes, keep my judgments, and do them, and hallow my Sabbaths. Hallow my Sabbaths, and they shall be a sign between me and you, that you may know that I am the eternal, your God. And did they follow? No, verse 21, notwithstanding the children rebelled against me. They walked not in my statutes, neither kept my judgments to do them, which if a man do, he shall even live by them. They polluted my Sabbaths. Then I said I would pour out my fury upon them to accomplish my anger against them in the wilderness, and that's what happened. What's the summary? If I were to categorize two specific things that Israel did to displease God, Sabbath breaking and idolatry, and they're actually connected. But I remember hearing Mr. Raymond Colt say that for years. The downfall of ancient Israel was Sabbath breaking and idolatry. Because they had their own ideas about what's right and what's good and what they ought to be allowed to do. That's idolatry. And they never would truly keep the Sabbaths the way God commanded them to do it, which means they ended up separated from God. And the end result of that way of thinking without repentance is death, which is why all that first generation, every single one of the first generation of Israel that walked out of Egypt, save for two ones, Joshua and Caleb, all died in the wilderness and did not go across the Jordan to inherit the promised land. And that is a warning and an example for you and me to help us to avoid doing the same thing. The difference is for you and me, it's not just a physical death with a chance to come up in a resurrection in the future like those ancient Israelites will do. This is our time. For you and me who are called now to be spiritual Israelites, begotten of the Spirit through baptism, this is your and my one and only opportunity. This is the brass ring. So idolatry and Sabbath breaking was their downfall. Likewise, my dear friends, if you fail to pass the big test, if you think there's going to be a big test for you, and you're just hoping you have the faith to do it, if you fail the big test to come, it will involve either Sabbaths or idolatry. How do you know that? I'm giving you a summary of what the history of ancient Israel shows and what Jesus Christ warned us against. And there it is. There it is. So I'm trying to give you some meaty material you can sink your teeth into to prepare yourself to pass the big test. Rather than just thinking you're already ready to stand in the face of the soldier and say, I will not renounce my religion. No, I'm going to give you something better. Here's my question. Are you putting God first right now while things are still good by comparison to the persecution which is ahead? How are you doing right now at obedience to these things? How to keep the Sabbaths? Let's run through very quickly. Exodus 34, 21. No, this isn't going to be a detail on specific do's and don'ts. We have all that documented. It was taught to the church, the true church of God. What's appropriate to do on the Sabbath and what's not appropriate to do. Especially what we should be doing different in mind. But let's look at a quick summary. Exodus 34, 21. 6 days thou shalt work, but on the seventh day thou shalt rest. In earing time and in harvest, meaning I don't care what your workload is, there are unusual times that come up when you really need to be working. Not all the time, but this is special. Surely I have a dispensation from God to get this done on the Sabbath. Which is why he said, in earing time and in harvest. That's one of those critical times for farmers. And God is saying, I don't care. Even when you think you need to work, This is unusual. This is crunch time. I need a special allowance from God. And he's saying, no. In earing time and in harvest, thou shalt rest. And thou shalt observe the Feast of Weeks. Ah, Pentecost. Of the first fruits of the wheat harvest and the Feast of Ingathering, Tabernacles. At year's end, thrice in the year shall all your men children appear before the eternal God, the God of Israel. Why just the males? Well, many have misunderstood it. I've tried to explain it. This, in ancient Israel, is talking about the inheritors. The males were the ones who owned the land that God gave to every family, the property from which wealth came, like from the agricultural products. So the patriarch of the family and the sons who were heirs had an accountability to pay the tithes and the offerings that came off of the blessings of that land. But who are the inheritors today spiritually? Just men in the church? No way. Every single one of you, male or female, is in line to be an inheritor in the kingdom of God. Because you are a future inheritor, you are accountable now, as if you were a man or a man-child or the patriarch of a family. We're going to see that momentarily, by the way. Deuteronomy 12, verse 5. Deuteronomy 12, verse 5, but unto the place which the eternal your God shall choose out of all your tribes to put his name, there even unto his habitation shall you seek, and thither thou you shall come. And how many want to argue about that today, thinking they can keep the Sabbath, quote unquote, at home? No, you can't. If your home is appointed by the ministry as a designated place for other brethren to come, then yes. But this idea that we're each just can just keep the Sabbaths by staying at our own homes and not coming together in a convocation is dead wrong. And it's a key way in which many of God's people at large today around the world are violating the Sabbaths. Verse 6, thither you shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices and your tithes and heave offerings in your hand and your vows and your freewill offerings and the firstlings of your herds and of your flocks. Verse 7, and there you shall eat before the eternal your God. And you shall rejoice in all that you put your hand unto, ye and your household, wherein the eternal your God hath blessed thee. You shall not do after all the things that we do here this day, every man whatsoever is right in his own eyes. How do you like them apples? How many ostensible members, quote unquote, of the church of God at large out there, scattered about, showing some level of respect for the things they learned either directly or indirectly through the ministry of Herbert Armstrong in the 20th century concerning Sabbaths and holy days and the master plan of God that he's working out, the first, second, third resurrection, you know, the immortality of the soul, heaven and hell and all of that. They believe all of that stuff, and yet they are not keeping the Sabbaths correctly because they are using their own standard rule, which flies in the face of what God said we're supposed to do. It's not just paying lip service to Saturdays or to holy days. It's about showing up where God is going to be and bringing your offerings to show respect to him in that place. Verse 11, then there shall be a place which the eternal your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. He's kind of adamant about this, I think. Am I making this up or do you see it? Thither shall you bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, your heave offerings, your hands, all the choice vows which you vow unto the eternal. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, ye and your sons and your daughters and your men servants and your maid servants. So there say it's not just the men. Everyone in the family of the Israelites, whoever that includes. God wants them all to be there. For as much as he hath no part, and the Levite that is within your gates, for as much as he has no part or inheritance with you, meaning he depends on the tithes of the rest of the nation in order for him to be able to attend the feast. Verse 13, take heed to thyself that thou offer not thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest. I can't tell you how many people I know are doing this. Well, I want to be at the Feast of Tabernacles, but, you know, I have this important thing I need to do, and there's another church that has a feast site in that area, so I'm going to go and, quote, keep the feast there. As if God is going to follow them around wherever they choose. Or the one that says, well, I can't really attend this year. And there's ones who cannot because of illness and disability. I'm not talking about them. But there are ones who could if they cared enough to pull out all stops to be there. But they're not. Oh, they've saved their second tithe. Oh, well, and so what do? They stay in their home area, and because they know they're not supposed to keep the feast at home, they're going to move into a hotel. They're going to use their second tithe to move into a nearby hotel and listen to sermons by recording and say that that's keeping the feast. Balderdash. That is using your own determination to supposedly keep the feast, and you're not. Because God says, don't do it, don't try it, I will not accept it. You must show up where I've placed my name. Verse 16, three times in a year shall all thy males, all thy inheritors, appear before the eternal thy God in the place which he shall choose, in the feast of unleavened bread, in the feast of weeks, in the feast of tabernacles, and they shall not appear before the eternal empty. So, first question to ask yourself, to what extent are you now when things are good? My dear friends, under the hearing of my voice, things in the world are as good as they're going to get. It's all downhill from here. How are you at prioritizing God's Sabbaths now? Now, we're a scattered group. Many of you do not have the opportunity to meet with others on weekly Sabbaths. I get that. And we've addressed that. We have provisions for that. No, you can't drive 300 miles every week to get together with the next nearest person. As often as you can, God will respect and honor that. But boy, when it comes to those annual holy days, the command for second tithe, and God makes provision financially and everything else, all you got to do is be willing to travel, to be inconvenienced a little bit. Why can't you be there if it's not because of your true physical disability? Why can't you be there? Fear? Fear of the unknown? You only feel comfortable in your little, habitat at home? So you'll make up all kind of excuses for why you can't travel a long distance? Really? You see, it is a faith test for many. Just to have to leave home to go to a place for an 8-day feast in the fall or Pentecost or unleavened bread or wherever is a major trial. For some, it's not. They love to travel, no big deal. Others, it's a big deal. But God says this is one of the requirements. Again, what was one of the main things he harped upon why Israel then failed to receive his grace? Because of their violation of the Sabbath principle, because they wanted to do it their way, not follow his instruction. What about us? If you are compromising keeping Sabbaths now, why do you think you will not compromise them under real pressure to come? We should be doing it now, because it's going to get harder, not easier. But what I'm telling you is, I'm pointing you toward what's a likely element of some of these big tests to come before the second coming of Jesus Christ, is because God is not going to suspend these commands concerning the Sabbaths. And that's going to become a big deal in the day when governments, let's say, impose martial law, and all of a sudden are trying to force you to stay at home and threatening you if you don't. Now, the closest thing we had to that in recent years, it was these COVID-19 lockdowns. First time I've had it in my life, where I've been faced with government entities that say you should be at home You can't be out with other people because of this pandemic, and this is a threat to, you know, the entire community. So you will be considered an enemy if you do not stay at home, let alone if you go out without a mask on, let alone if you think you're going to get together in a social gathering like a church service. And so what did they do? They began to persecute churches. Well, now, mainly the churches that got persecuted were ones that were like sticking their finger in the eye, intentionally bringing attention to themselves. We didn't do that. But we continued to have our holy convocations and to provide a place in God's name for people to come together, like we did right here in Eugene, Oregon. Even though the local government in the state of Oregon and in the city of Eugene was telling us, don't do it, you'll be in trouble. And we did it anyway. Not because we're trying to flaunt their law, but because their law was in opposition to our commandment to God, from God. So we continued to have our convocations here. We did it as discreetly as possible. We weren't trying to bring attention to ourselves, but we did not stop meeting. And a majority of these other splinter groups that came out of Worldwide Church of God stopped meeting. And their ministers told their people to stay at home. In other words, they said, don't keep the Sabbath because you don't want to get in trouble with the government. We had one guy that came with us for a while. He didn't stay, but only because he was a member of one of these other splinter groups, but they weren't meeting, so he came to our services for a couple of years. Just because we were meeting. I think that's a lot more realistic potential threat to the people of God between now and the second coming of Jesus Christ. More events where cataclysmic things are going to happen. Governments are going to clamp down on their populations for reason, and they're going to tell us to stay at home. And in order for you to keep the Sabbath, you can't stay at home. Are you going to stop going to the Feast of Tabernacles because you're afraid to get arrested? You see, it's one thing to envision the idea the soldier's going to come and knock on your door at home. It's another thing because you're keeping the feast in faith and thereby perhaps putting yourself in the gun sights of those who are going to make an example out of you because you didn't follow the rule. But you see, I believe this Sabbath keeping thing that we believe in is going to be the source of a lot of our persecution in the future. Not because we're trying to draw attention to ourselves. We just want to keep obeying God in secret and private, discreetly. But by virtue of continuing to obey the command to assemble, it will likely bring us under scrutiny. Would you be willing to keep going to church, let alone going to the feast? How do we show real love for Christ? I'm talking about Matthew 24:10, where Christ said what's going to happen is many are going to be offended and turn on each other. How are you going to be one who doesn't turn on your brothers and sisters of the faith? Matthew 25, verse 31. I'll read it very, very quickly through verse 40. Matthew 25, 31, when the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon his throne of glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared to you from the foundation of the world. You and I want to be in that group, don't we? Then shall the king say unto them on his, verse 35, for I was hungered, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee hungered and fed thee? We don't remember ever doing that. One, because we didn't have that kind of a personal, direct relationship with you. Or thirsty and gave you drink. When saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick or in prison and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto one of these, the least of my brethren, you have done it unto me. Want to show love for Christ? Want to serve Him? He says, your opportunity and my opportunity and my obligation and your obligation is how we treat one another. And God is reading the way we treat one another as a way we feel about Him. So my question is, if Christ also said in Matthew 24 that when persecution comes and in fact people start dying, and then panic sets in by nature to the carnal mind, and He said what's going to happen is many are going to turn on one another and betray each other and sell each other out. I can run scenarios in my head that could fit it. Like this thing about Sabbath keeping. What happens if you end up on a list because you were part of a group that was considered now to become, you know, a threat to the government? If you were a part of any group that had any historical ties to the Worldwide Church of God, let's say, you're in a dangerous cult and you need to be rooted out. But let's say you're one now that's decided to sit home. Well, I'm going to protect myself. Surely God doesn't expect me to keep going to Sabbath services and the Feast of Tabernacles. Surely. So I'm going to make that decision in my mind, and I'm going to stay at home. But the government rep is still going to knock on my door. Not a soldier, social worker, somebody who's trying to suss out if I'm a danger. Oh, no. I'm following the rules. See, I'm at home. Yeah, I used to be a part of that group, but I'm not now. Please leave me and my family alone. Oh, they're not convinced. So what's the next possible thing you or I could do? I'm not going now, but I can tell you where some are still. You see how that can happen? Oh, I would never do that, said Peter. Said you, said me, I would never do that. Why do you think you wouldn't? What do you got going for you that makes you so much stronger in faith than the Apostle Peter or the other disciples who sold out Jesus Christ? Where's the substance to your pronouncement? This could easily happen. And before you know it, or before I know it, just like poor Peter, he wasn't planning on renouncing Christ or selling Him out. He got caught up in the moment when he was in that courtyard. You're one of those disciples who followed this, weren't you? Didn't I see you? And you've got the accent of a, I don't know the guy. Before you know it, his knee-jerk reaction, self-preservation in the carnal mind. He wasn't thinking about it. He just did it. And Christ looked right on him when He announced him three times. You're really better. You're really stronger. You really have your act together more than Peter did. You can. But what's the proof of it? Will you sell out a brother to save yourself from the soldier who knocks on the door? You think no? What's your evidence? What are you doing now to demonstrate? You're already showing the kind of character to help you avoid falling into that trap. Matthew 5, 43 through 48 tells you, if you want to be a true Christian, you got to love your enemies, not just the ones who like you and treat you well and make you feel good when you're around them. You got to be willing to put yourself out there even for people who hate you and despitefully use you. How are we doing at that? I would assert to you that if you're one who is learning to practice that, the idea of making yourself a living sacrifice instead of being caught up in yourself, in your own little world, in your wants, and in fact, you have created the habit of being a servant to others, which means you subjugate the way you want things to be physically for the benefit of others. And that goes against our nature. It goes against mine and it goes against yours because we are selfish creatures. So if you are using the Holy Spirit right now, when times are good, and you are actually learning to subjugate your desires carnally and to be an outgoing servant to others, you're going to be in a much stronger position to be able to do it when times are tough, don't you think? Maybe. Because you have already created the habit. Now, this was different for Peter and the disciples. I'm going to turn into all those texts that showed their infighting. Didn't they? And even right up until that night of the Passover, they were still arguing about who was going to be greater in the kingdom. They were still vying with one another. Jealousy. Had they instead already had a converted mind, which they all got later, and had been learning to pour themselves out for others rather than protect the self, they would have been in a stronger position when the pressure came, instead of a knee-jerk giving in to safeguarding the self, to saying, no, I'm going to continue to obey God. I'm going to keep the Sabbaths, no matter what the government says. And if pressured, I'm not going to sell anyone out. Because I already have a track record of actually living that way now, which means it's going to be easier for me to keep doing that if it's a good habit I'm already actuating. Isaiah 58. Under personal threat, the natural human response is every man for himself. And that's exactly what Christ said is going to happen to members of the church when faced with persecution and tribulation before the second coming of Jesus Christ. Do you believe that's true, what we read in Matthew 24:10? Many are going to betray one another and hate one another.
Oh, I would never do that.
Your best hope of never doing that is recognizing in yourself the possibility and the likelihood that you might. Because if you are thoughtful about that, then you are in a position to actually train yourself with God's help out of that orientation. Isaiah 58, which is a whole chapter. I'm going to start in verse 5. Don't have time to read the whole thing. The topic of Isaiah 58 are God's true people. These were Israelites, and these were ones who were trying to obey, including fasting. Not just on atonement, but personal fast. They were trying to grow close to God. They were trying to honor God. And they were frustrated, which is what the first verses show. What's all that? You know, we're doing all this. We're making these sacrifices. And God is far away from us. What gives? Pick it up in verse 5. Here's God's answer. So these aren't people who are running away from the doctrine, supposedly. They're trying to obey, but they're frustrated because they feel like it's not helping them. And then God gives them the answer, why? Why is your religion and why is your Sabbath keeping or fast and your study and everything you're trying to do to serve God, why are you not actually receiving the blessings that God promised? Here's the answer. Verse 5, is it such a fast that I have chosen? Is this really the way I want you to fast? Well, what do you mean? I'm doing it, like you said, I'm fasting for 24 hours. I'm not eating or drinking anything starting at sunset until the following sunset. I'm following the rule. Is this such a fast that I have chosen, a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head as a bulrush, to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Wilt thou call this a fast and an acceptable day of the eternal? Is it just about the physical, not eating and drinking? And you think you're fulfilling what's behind fasting and the plan of God? Including keeping atonement, one of those holy days, one of those Sabbaths, let alone personal fasts. You're going through the motions, you're doing it right, you're checking the box, but you still feel unfulfilled. Why? God is saying, you think that's all I want is just for you to go through the motions physically and check the box? Verse 6, is not this the fast that I have chosen? to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every... Oh, wait. What does that have to do with fasting? This now is talking about my behavior to other people. What does it have to do with personal fasting? Is God just duplicitous in his thinking here, or does it link up? Yeah, it links up. You see, because fasting at the root is sacrificing self, isn't it? Your body demands food and water. I think yours does. No, mine does. And if I don't eat, I get hungry. And if I get hungry, I might get hangry. So I need water and I need food. So when you fast, when you choose to fast, what you're doing is intentionally depriving yourself of something that your being physically wants and demands. And you're suppressing that. You're saying, no, I am going to make this sacrifice before God to show honor for him by sacrificing, by subduing a natural urge within me. And I'm not going to act upon it. That's really what's happening with fasting. So what God is doing here is he's taking the physical principle of fasting, just not eating and drinking for a period of time, and he's converting this over now to how we behave one to another. So what is the principle of self-deprivation in regards to one another? It means instead of demanding what we want to make ourselves happy in our relationships with other people, we're willing to sacrifice ourselves, our wants, our demands, our insistencies, and we're willing instead, in a servantly mode, to pour ourselves out to serve others, even when they make mistakes. Which is where Matthew 5 comes in it. Serve your enemies, not just the ones who you like and think deserve a good turn. It's like being willing to pour yourself out, even when some people are misbehaving. And you're going to serve them because you're going to fast with your ego. You're going to go on an ego fast. How do you like that? I just made that up. You're going to go on an ego fast. And you know what? If you learn to go on an ego fast, you're in a better position not to fall into the Matthew 24:10 scenario of being offended. Don't you think? The people of God, by and large, are going to become offended and turn on each other. How do you and I avoid that? Because we have been regularly going on ego fasts. Learning to subdue our own natural inclinations of self-defense and subjugating that for the sake of pouring ourselves out for the benefit of others. And if you've made a habit of that, it's like exercising a muscle, which is going to make you stronger, which means then when you're facing bigger tests to come, like threats to the church, you are more prepared, spiritually in shape, to avoid naturally falling into the trap of circling the wagons around yourself in your ego and preserving yourself and selling everybody else out in fear. Wouldn't that be a good way to spend our time, do you think? Is this not the fast that I have chosen, to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke? Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house, when thou seest the naked, that thou cover him, and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh? I'm not just talking about doing good works in the community. You know, periodically going to a nursing home and giving out bananas. I use that as an example because I did that once on a visit to my grandmother, probably about 10 years old, and she wanted us to do something like that. So we took these bunches of bananas to a neighborhood nursing home and went to all the rooms and handed out bananas. My grandmother was a good Sunday-keeping Baptist. Is that all it is? Or are we talking about a change of mind? To hide thyself from thy own flesh. Who is God talking about? Just your physical flesh and blood family members? Because the Bible also says the big source of our problem in the last days, if we hold on to the true faith of God, is going to come from the attacks of our families. But spiritually, you see, we're supposed to be a family. And we're supposed to look out for one another and defend each other. Even when we make mistakes, we rally around each other. I'm not talking about justifying heresy. I'm talking about covering personal mistakes. Verse 8, then shall thy light. God's saying, if for these frustrated Israelites who are fasting, they're going through the motions, but they're not getting any spiritual results and they're frustrated about it. He's saying, here's the answer. This is what you need to do. Then, if you follow this program, then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily. How many people even have physical maladies in the church, and we're looking for solutions? And maybe the biggest solution is a change of mind. Mr. Armstrong used to say that the mind can absolutely poison the body. I believe that's true. So I wonder how many illnesses of legitimate, baptized members of God's church at large around the world actually might be rooted because of a poisonous orientation of mind that they haven't gotten rid of yet. That's what this seems to indicate. That we literally flood our system with poison because we're roiling in our minds and can't find a way to stop it. Then shall thy light break forth as the morning, thine health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go before thee. Not a pseudo-righteousness, not a put-on, not a pretense, but he's talking about a real manifestation of what he wants us to do, which is a change of the way we think. The glory of the eternal shall be thy reward. There's no reason that we shouldn't have all these blessings God wants. You are called of God. You are sanctified and set apart, and you do have access to all these blessings. There's no reason you should not have the greatest blessings of all. I'm not talking about getting money and wealth in this world. That's not what he promised us. But he promised us, most of all, peace of mind. Peace of mind. He also promised us we're going to go through tribulation and trial, so get ready for the hard stuff physically. Don't sign up to be a Christian if you want an easy walk physically. Christ died. You're walking in his footsteps. We need to be willing likewise to suffer, even to die. But do it with good grace, like he did on the stake when he said, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. There's the orientation that can make you a blessed person no matter what you endure by God's plan. But you got to go on an ego fast, and me too. You got to go on an ego fast. You got to learn to subdue it, the impulse, which is always there. You don't have to think about it. If I haven't eaten in 24 hours, I keep being reminded that I haven't eaten in 24 hours because my stomach keeps telling me. And I can try and distract myself, but it keeps coming to my mind. Verse 9, then shall thou call. This was the problem. These Israelites, God was far away from them. They're saying, we're fasting, we're doing all this stuff, and God's still far away from us. What gives? Then he says, shall thou call, and the Eternal shall answer. Thou shalt cry, and he shall say, here am I. Here I am. If what? Why? If thou take away from the midst of thee the yoke. What yoke? I don't even have a yoke. I don't own a yoke. Yeah. I can place a yoke on anybody else when I have an expectation of them, when I think they haven't done something, or they have done something wrong, or they haven't done something they should have done. I've just put my little invisible yoke on them, and I have hard feelings against them until they fix it. And then if they do everything I think they should, I might take the yoke off. Otherwise, I have harnessed them. I've never done that. Then who is he talking to? Who is he talking to? If thou take away from the midst of thee the yoke, the putting forth of the finger, Maybe that resonates a little more. The putting forth of the finger. The speaking vanity. Well, when I put forth the finger to point out somebody's mistakes, it's not vanity because I am judging wisely. In many cases, God says, no, it's vanity, which is emptiness, worthlessness. It's foolishness. And we get caught up in stupid stuff, pointing the finger. And God says, you want to be close to me? You want to have me at your disposal when you cry out and have me answering your prayers? Take care of this stuff in your backyard. Figure out where you are imposing burdens on others. Pointing the finger. And stop it. Verse 10, if thou draw out thy soul to the hungry, not just going to volunteer at a soup kitchen, to ladle out soup to the homeless. There are members of the church who are hungry spiritually and mentally. They lack. And maybe just by your positive communication and spending time with them, you may feed them. Draw out thy soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul. It's about outwardly looking for ways to help others rather than just getting everything that we want. Then shall thy light rise in obscurity and in darkness be as the noonday. And the eternal shall guide thee continually and satisfy the soul in drought, make fat thy bones. Thou shalt be like a watered garden and like a spring of water whose water fails not. This is a promise. There is no reason every single one of us should not feel this way. Right now. So the question is, if you don't, why not? Verse 12, and they that shall be of thee shall build the old waste places. So now we've got a long-range prophecy saying that the ones who do this successfully, who change their minds, who go on an ego fast to suppress their own selfish desires in order to make themselves the habit of serving others, like Christ did, what's waiting for you is a place in the kingdom of God as a king and a priest. That's who's going to do this. They shall be of thee that shall build the old waste places. That means when Christ returns and rules over this earth, the members of the God family then are going to fix everything that's broken on this planet. Thou shalt raise up the foundations of many generations, and thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of the paths to dwell in. Verse 13, if, here's the condition. You want to be in that category? Sure you do, and so do I. I want to be one that receives a reward when Christ returns. Who's going to do it? If thou turn away thy foot from the Sabbath. Oh, we haven't heard about the Sabbath this whole chapter, but here it is. It always seems to come up. If thou turn away thy foot from the Sabbath, from doing thy pleasure on my holy day. So it's not ones who just deny the Sabbath. It's the ones who reinterpret how to keep the Sabbath according to their own whims. From doing thy pleasure on my holy day and call the Sabbath a delight. Is the Sabbath a delight? Sometimes in some ways and in other ways. So we still have work to do to learn not just to keep it as a Pharisee, but to come to love the Sabbath. That's got to be the Holy Spirit changing your mind and mine. Because we just simply don't do that by nature, which is why the ancient Israelites never could keep them for very long, because they didn't like them. And call the Sabbath a delight, the holy of the eternal, honorable, and shall honor him, not doing thine own ways or finding thine own pleasure, nor speaking thine own words. Then, so what are the two pieces that are a part of Isaiah 58 as far as solution to our spiritual problems? The way we treat one another and our respect for the Sabbath. Then, verse 14, thou shalt delight thyself in the Lord, and I will cause thee to ride upon the high places of the earth. That means as an immortal member of God's family. and feed thee with the heritage of Jacob thy father, for the mouth of the Eternal has spoken it. God says, I'm serious about this. I've made a promise, I've bound myself, and I'm going to do this. Somebody's going to receive this reward. Somebody in the last days is going to make it through every trial, every threat, every tribulation. And there are going to be ones who receive that immortality and that power with Christ in that day. But he's got all these warnings for us to tell us what we need to do. So I go back to the beginning. You know, if you think your only worry is to summon enough faith so that when the soldier knocks on your door and says, renounce your cult religion of the past or else I'm hauling you off to jail, I hope I have the strength to say, I will not renounce my God. As if that's what he's looking for. No, that could be a part of it, but it's so much more. Because what God said, what Christ said, is our real threat are the natural choices we make under pressure to protect the self. Like not going to church service because there's a danger now. Martial law says I'm not supposed to go out, let alone go into this assembly. Let alone if your church is one that actually makes it on a blacklist, a dangerous cult, and they might be scoping out anybody who shows up in an assembly of that group. Are you going to go anyway because you're walking into the lion's mouth? Or might you find a way to justify staying at home? There's where the Sabbath actually could become the linchpin. Even though you respect the Sabbath, you believe in the Sabbath, but you might stay home under threat to life and limb. Would you have the faith to keep keeping the Sabbaths no matter what? So it's not about staying and waiting for the soldier to knock on your door. You're going to have to go out. You're going to have to leave your home. And that's really where your dangers might come from most of all. But see, if you're a true Christian, then you respect the Sabbaths and the holy days, which means you can't avoid going out of your home. Are you prepared for that? And are you prepared to make yourself a living sacrifice for your brothers and sisters? Others, I mean, the people we come into in contact with in the world, yes, but especially those of the household of faith. And if you have a habit of service and self-sacrifice, of suppressing the ego, of ego fasting, you're in a better position than under great stress and threat not to sell out your brothers and sisters, not to turn and point your finger all of a sudden when things get bad in the world. So there's my two-part formula for being ready to pass the big test. Never renounce keeping the Sabbaths like ancient Israel did and turning to idolatry, and never stop pouring yourself out like Jesus Christ showed us by example to serve one another.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented How to Pass the Big Test, a message given by Mr. John Brisby in Eugene, Oregon, June 1st, 2024.